crying when she fell and hurt her knee. "Papa," she said, her voice thick. "I was worried you'd hate me for going. But Mama said, 'No, baby, no.'" Baja hugged her again. "You go. And when they let the ship leave, you go to Ceres and become a doctor and have a fantastic life." "Why?"
"Because the people here see your death as a tool for winning a public opinion battle. Because I've lost all the children I ever planned to lose. Because I can't have you see me when they finally arrest me." "Because I love you, baby," he said instead. "And I want you to go be amazing."
She hugged him, and for that one moment, all was right in the universe again. Baja watched as she boarded, stopping just inside the airlock to wave and blow him a kiss. He watched as they loaded the last of the ore into the cargo compartment. He watched as the shuttle lifted off with a roar and wash of heat. Then, he turned back toward town to find Holden. Holden and Amos were sitting in the commissary's tiny bar. Amos drank and watched everyone who came in through the door. He held his glass with his left hand, his right never far from the gun at his belt. Holden was typing rapidly on a hand terminal lying on the table. Both men looked tense. Baja walked toward them, smiling and nodding his head and keeping his hands visible and away from his body. Amos smiled back. The big man's scalp looked pale and shiny under the commissary's white LEDs. When he leaned forward in his chair, it looked perfectly natural and non-threatening, and Baja noted that it also put the gun closer to hand, seemingly by accident. They were not the sort of details he would have noticed before. Coop and Kate and the violence of the last few months had left him on edge, seeing the potential for violence everywhere. When he looked at Amos, he suspected his instincts were not wrong. Raising his hands, he said, "Captain Holden, can I join you for a moment?" Holden's head darted up, startled and frightened. Baja was pretty sure he was not the source of the man's fear and wondered what was. Murtry and his corporate killers? Had Holden heard from someone else about the planned attack? "Please," Holden said, the fear disappearing from his face as quickly as it had come. He gestured at one of their table's empty chairs. "What can I do for you?" Amos said nothing, just kept smiling his vague smile. Baja sat, making sure to keep his hands on the table and in plain view. "Captain, I've come to warn you."
"About?"
Amos said at once. Holden said nothing. "There is a group here. The same group that attacked and killed the RCE security team prior to your arrival. They plan to kill the remaining security people sometime in the next few days. Maybe as early as tomorrow night." Holden and Amos shared a quick look.
"We've been expecting something like that," Holden said.
"But that's not the important—" Baja didn't let him finish. "They also plan to kill you." Holden sat up a little straighter. He didn't seem angry so much as offended.
"Me? Why would they want to kill me?"
"They think it will send a message," Baja said, his tone apologetic. "Also, they're mad about the explosives inspectors."
"Told you," Holden said to Amos. "A good compromise pisses everyone off."
Without realizing he was going to do it, Baja grabbed the bottle off the table and took a long drink. It must have been something they had brought with them, because it was much better whiskey than anything the colony had access to. It warmed his throat and belly pleasantly, but didn't calm him as much as he'd hoped. He pushed the bottle back toward Amos, but the big man stopped him.
"You keep that, brother. You look like you need it."
"What are you going to do?"
Baja asked Holden.
"About the assassination?
Nothing.
It won't matter because we're all leaving.
We're evacuating the planet. All of us. Everyone.
No, Baja said. No one's leaving. We can't go now. I helped kill people to stay here. Oh, we really are, Holden said. Something very bad is happening on this planet, and it has nothing to do with obstinate belters or sociopathic corporate security. Baja took another long drink from the bottle. The alcohol was starting to leave him a little fuzzy, but not any less anxious. I don't understand. Somebody used to live here, Holden said, waving one arm around. It took Baja's drink-addled mind a moment to realize Holden didn't mean the commissary. Maybe they're gone, and maybe they aren't, but they left a lot of stuff behind, and some of it's waking up. So before we wind up being Eros with a great big sky, everyone is getting the hell out of Dodge. Baja nodded without understanding. Amos grinned at him and said, The towers and robots, man. It means the alien shit. Looks like some of it's waking up. I'm sending a message to the ROSI right now to bounce it on to the UN and the OPA Council, Holden continued. My recommendation is that everyone get into orbit as soon as possible. I'm asking for emergency command of the Israel and the Barbapiccola to facilitate that. That isn't going to happen, Baja said, his voice soft. It's not an easy sell, Holden said, but I can be persuasive. And once I have command, they won't go, Baja said. People already bled for this land, died for it, were willing to kill each other to stay here. We'll sure as hell stay and fight whatever else wants us gone. Providing there's anyone left, Amos said. Well, sure, Baja agreed. Providing that. Chapter 18. Holden. Murtry and his security team had converted the small prefab security outpost into a fortress. The inner walls had been sprayed with energy-absorbing foam that looked like whipped cream, but formed a ballistic barrier that could stop small arms fire and light explosives. A large gun cage sat against one wall, secured with a biometric lock. It had only a few guns in it. Since Holden didn't know exactly how many the security team had brought with them, that was either a good thing or a bad thing. Murtry sat behind a small desk with a hand terminal lying on it. He leaned back in his chair, hands behind his head, a vague smile on his face. He looked like a man with all the time in the world. Did you hear me when I said that people are planning to murder your team? Holden asked. I wish you'd stop using that word, Carol Chiwiwi said. She insisted on being present at any meeting between Holden and the RCE people, and it had seemed like a reasonable request. Now, with her own people plotting an attack, it felt like a security risk. Murder? Murtry said. Terrorism has a nice ring to it. Homicide always sounded a bit legalistic to me. Pretentious. Wait, Holden cut in before Carol could respond to Murtry's baiting. Cut that out right now. My capacity for giving a shit about your little tiff down here has hit its limit. This is no longer a negotiation of rights or a discussion of who attacked who first. No, Murtry said. And what is it then? It's about me telling you what's going to happen. Telling, Murtry said. You're not in charge here, Carol added. Holden squashed the irritation he felt at their taking sides only to make his life harder. Two things have changed recently, and one hasn't, he said, working to keep his tone pleasant. The violence is about to escalate, with us teetering on the edge of an all-out shooting war between the colony and RCE, and probably, more importantly, the alien stuff left on this planet is waking up. What's the one that didn't? Murtry asked. What? The one thing that didn't change. Right, Holden said, leaning across the desk toward him. I'm still the only guy in the system with a warship in orbit. So, with those three things in mind, we're leaving this planet before you idiots can kill any more of each other or before the aliens kill all of us. Threats now, Carol said behind him. Without looking away from Murtry, Holden said, You bet, if that's what it takes. Start getting your people ready for evac. Get the Israel shuttles down here. Do it now. The Israel is leaving with me in 30 hours, and you'll want to be on it when we go. You can't, Carol said, and Holden spun around to face her. I can. We'll get the Barb shuttle back down here, and I suggest you have your people pack up everything they care about and start getting on it, because the Barb is leaving. Carol's mouth went tight and her hands curled into fists. You done? Murtry asked, his voice light. May I present my rebuttal? There isn't one, Holden said, pulling a chair up to the desk and sitting down, showing he didn't care about the trappings of control the security office gave Murtry. So, here's the price of fame, Murtry continued. You are one of the most recognized people in the solar system. It's why they sent you. Fame gives you the illusion of power. But it's all just a facade. No, the fact that I own the Rosinante, Murtry patted the air again in the same condescending gesture he'd used on Carol. You're famous for being the man who tries to save everyone. For being the solar system's white knight. Tilting at giants like Protogen and Mao Quick. Your ship's got the right name. Murtry laughed at Holden's frown. Yeah, I've read a book, Murtry went on. So that's why they send you here. No one will expect the great James Holden to take sides, of secretly backing either the colonists or one of those nasty Earth corporations. You're the man without an agenda or subtext. Great, Holden said. Thanks for the insight. Now call your people and... But we're 18 months from the closest legal remedy. And the only real power you have out here is violence. You're the violent man here, Carol said, making an accusation. I am, Murtry agreed. I understand its uses better than most. And the thing I know about you, Captain Holden, is that you are not. Now, if that brute you brought with you were in here making these threats, well, I'd have to take that seriously. But not from you. You've got a warship in orbit right now that could blow the Israel and the Barbapicola into glowing slag, then rain down destruction on this planet that would wipe out every shred of human life in this solar system. But you're not the man to pull that trigger. And we both know it. Save your threats. They're embarrassing. You're out of control, Holden replied. You're insane. And as soon as RCE finds out what? That the UN mediator got spooked because there was an alien artifact on an alien planet and I didn't? Murtry interrupted. Send in a full report. I'm sure that with your reputation and the backing of the UN and OPA, your words will be given serious consideration. And maybe, 3 years from now, a replacement will arrive to relieve me of duty. Holden stood up, dropping his hand at the butt of his gun. Or maybe I relieve you right now. The room went silent for a moment. Carol seemed to be holding her breath. Murtry frowned up at Holden, seemingly taken off guard for the first time. Holden waited, not breaking eye contact, angry enough to draw on Murtry and furious with himself for letting it get to that point. Murtry smiled. It did nothing to break the tension. If you brought the other one with you, that threat might have some weight. We both know who the killer on your crew is. If you think I wouldn't blow you out of that chair right this second to save everyone else on this planet, then you don't know me at all. There were scratching sounds on the floor as Carol shuffled back toward the door and out of the potential firing line. Holden kept his eyes on Murtry. The man frowned up at him for several seconds, then shifted back to the vague smile. Here we go, Holden thought, and tried not to let the rush of adrenaline make his hand shake. When the hand terminal on the desk squawked a connection request, Holden was so startled that he half drew his gun before he could stop himself. Murtry didn't move. The terminal screeched again.
May I answer that?
Murtry asked. Holden just nodded at him, dropping his gun back into its holster. Murtry picked up the terminal and opened the connection.
Way here, a voice said.
Go ahead.
Team in position. Birds are all in the nest and tooling up. Are we a go?
Hold, Murtry said,
then put the terminal down and looked back up at Holden.
You're still twitching over what happened on Eros. I get that. You're not rational about all this alien shit, and honestly, who would be? I forgive you for the threats. And I appreciate that your initial purpose in coming here was to warn me about the danger to my team. It says something to me that in spite of our differences, you're still trying to save my people.
No one needs to die here, Holden said, hoping against hope that Murtry was backing down.
Well, that's not strictly speaking true, Murtry replied. I'm good at this job. Did you think I didn't know about this little uprising? I knew before you did.
The security teams constantly patrolling the town would never have gotten close enough to listen in.
You've been bugging the town. Every building in it, Murtry agreed. So, while I appreciate you coming here, I think I've got the situation handled.
You bugged my town?
Carol asked, anger seeming to win out over her fear.
What are you doing? Holden said. Don't do something stupid.
Murtry just smiled again, picked up his hand terminal and said, Strike team is go. The gunshots outside were softened by the foam covering the walls and sounded like a rapid string of faint pops, like distant fireworks or a bad hydraulic seal finally letting go.
Oh no, Carol said and rushed to the door.
Holden followed her, fumbling with his hand terminal to call Amos. Outside, the sound was much louder. The staccato reports of gunfire splitting the peaceful night air, the flashes, a distant strobe lighting up the far edge of town. Holden ran toward the shots, shouting into his terminal for Amos to come. He stumbled in the dark, dropping it, but didn't stop to pick it up. At the northern edge of town, he found the rest of Murtry's security team firing on one of the houses. Shots were coming back at them from inside. The security people were shouting at the people in the house to surrender, the people inside cursing and firing in answer. Smoke poured out one of the house's broken windows, something inside burning.
Stop it!
Holden yelled as he ran toward the RCE people. They ignored him and continued to pour fire into the house. Answering bullets hit one of the RCE people in the chest, the body armor making a dull thud as it stopped the round. The security woman fell on her back, yelling in pain and surprise. The rest of the team opened up on the window the shot had come from, blasting the frame and inside wall behind it into splinters. The blaze inside the house spread suddenly with a wave of heat and a whooshing sound. Someone inside screamed in panic or pain. The front door, already just a mass of carbon fiber splinters from gunfire, swung open. A woman rushed out, a rifle in her hands. The security team shot her into a splatter of blood, and she collapsed at the bottom of the steps, twitching.
They're burning!
Holden yelled, grabbing the nearest RCE person by the arms and shaking him.
We have to get them out!
The man responded by shoving him away.
Stay back until the area is cleared, sir.
Holden shoved back, hard enough to put the RCE man on his ass in the dirt, and ran toward the fallen woman at the front of the house. Someone inside
must have thought he was attacking, because a shotgun blast rang out and the ground a meter behind him flew up in a miniature explosion of dust. The RCE people opened up, and Holden found himself between two different firing lines. Again. Some distant and still calm part of his brain thought, marveling at how often this sort of thing seemed to happen. He dove to the ground and rolled his body on top of the fallen woman, screaming for everyone to stop. No one listened. The fire in the house billowed out with another loud whump, and the heat scorched the exposed skin on Holden's face and hands. The gunshots from inside the house cut off all at once, and the RCE returned fire soon after. Holden grabbed the fallen woman by the arms and dragged her away from the flames. He stumbled when he reached the RCE people, falling down at their feet. "Help her!" he croaked at the woman who reached down to help him up. He pushed himself up to his hands and knees, but stopped there, too dizzy to stand. Another member of the security team was already bending over her. "This one's dead." Holden collapsed back to the ground, suddenly robbed of strength. Too late. The big meat grinder he was trying to save these people from just kept chewing away relentlessly, and they kept lining up to throw themselves inside. The RCE people were helping their fallen comrade, and she was insisting that she was fine, that the armor had stopped the round, that she'd just have a big bruise. Someone joked about idiots bringing slingshots to a gunfight, followed by laughter. All the while, the house burned, filling the air with acrid black smoke and the smell of hot epoxy and cooking pork. The RCE people seemed to remember he was there, and several came over to look down at him. "Secure him," one said. "Way." The one who'd come out to look at the alien robot with them. The one who'd shot it. She stared down, nothing like compassion in her eyes. "Fuck you," Holden said, trying to push himself back up to his feet. "You aren't securing shit." Way smashed him in the chest with a rifle butt, knocking him back to the ground. One of the other security people pointed his rifle at Holden. He found himself thinking it was very likely he was about to be shot.
"Hold on now,"
a calm voice said. Murtry strode into view out of the darkness.
"No one's shooting Captain Holden."
"He tried to help the terrorists," Way said.
"Did he?" Murtry feigned shock. "You didn't, did you? That would be a violation of the neutrality of your position here, wouldn't it?"
"I tried to help a woman who'd been shot," Holden replied, slowly climbing to his feet. His sternum felt bruised. That was all right. It would only hurt when he breathed.
"That sounds reasonable," Murtry said. "Is that the extent of his aid to the terrorists?"
Way nodded, then looked away, annoyed.
"Then there's no reason to detain you,"
Murtry continued, his voice full of good cheer. "He's insane," Holden thought. "He's gone completely over the edge. I could kill him right now and end this." In his mind, he could picture Miller nodding in approval at the thought. "Sir," Way said, bringing a rifle up to her shoulder and aiming into the darkness beyond the firelight. "Incoming."
"Hold your panties,"
Amos said from the dark and stepped into the light. He had Baja Merton and Carol Chiwiwi and a number of other colonists with him.
"My God," Carol said, looking at the fire. "Did anyone get out?"
One of the security people pointed his rifle at the body lying on the ground.
"She did."
"Zadie," Baja said. "They killed her." Murtry stepped forward and cleared his throat. When everyone was looking at him, he said,
"My team surrounded the house where a cell of known terrorists were actively preparing to murder myself, the entire RCE security detachment, and Captain Holden. They had firearms and possibly explosives. When the RCE security team demanded that they exit the building unarmed and with their hands up, They opened fire. All of the terrorists were killed by the return fire. It's possible that explosives the terrorists were planning to use acted as an accelerant when the house started burning. Everything done here was by the book and appropriate for protecting RCE personnel and the UN/OPA mediator from harm. Carol looked at the blazing house with a stunned expression.
Appropriate?
Mr. Merton, Murtry continued. So glad you could join us. Sergeant Way, take Baja Merton into custody.
What?
Baja said, raising his hands and backing up.
Why me?
No, Holden said, stepping in front of Way and planting his hand on the breastplate of her armor. Not happening.
Mr. Merton was a party to this conspiracy, Murtry said, speaking loud enough for the gathering crowd of colonists to hear.
He attended the secret meeting at which the attack was planned, and there is significant evidence that he was a participant in the attack which killed five of my people. Might have something to say about what happened to Governor Trying, too.
Lowering his voice, he said, Out of the way, Holden, or we'll just go through you.
Way smiled at him, without humor. One of the other RCE people walked around them toward Baja, a plastic wrist restraint in his hands. Amos stepped in front of Baja and punched the RCE man in the face. It sounded like a hammer hitting a side of beef. The security man fell to the ground, a puppet whose strings had been cut.
Nope,
Amos said, then shook his right hand with a grimace and added,
Ouch.
The rest of the security team brought their rifles to bear on him. Holden saw Amos drop his right hand toward his gun, then stepped in front of him and yelled,
Stop! We're taking him in, Murtry said, pointing at Baja.
One way or the other. We'll let the assault on one of my people slide for now. Emotions running hot and all.
We're all leaving, anyway, Holden said, keeping his voice low, appealing to Murtry rather than the crowd.
You have no authority to order anyone to leave, Murtry replied. I hoped we were done with that.
In the meantime, Holden continued as though Murtry hadn't spoken, the UN is taking custody of this man, Baja, as part of our investigation. He'll be secure on my ship. He won't be a threat to your people down here. And when we all get back, you can present your evidence and have him arrested.
Get back, Murtry said with a lazy smile. Just going to keep him in a holding cell for the next few years? Because I accused him of something?
If I have to, Holden said. Because I don't believe for a second that you wouldn't kill him.
Murtry shrugged.
Okay. He's your baggage, then. Just keep him off my planet.
Baja looked stunned, his eyes focused on nothing in particular. The colonists began organizing a firefighting detail to put the blaze out. Murtry and his team stood and watched, not offering to help. A visible reminder of the threat they presented next to the violence of their handiwork. Holden headed back into town, Baja and Amos in tow. He patted his pockets looking for his hand terminal before remembering he'd dropped it on the run out to the fight. He'd never find it in the dark, so he borrowed Amos's and called the ship.
Naomi, he said once she'd picked up, bring the Rosie down to the landing area. We're going to need you to offload our heavier armor and some bigger firepower.
This doesn't sound good, she said.
It's not. Have you heard back from the UN or Fred yet?
Nothing yet.
I take it this means RCE and the Ganymede folks aren't in a big hurry to leave?
No,
Holden said with a heavy sigh.
No, they'd rather stay here and kill each other, right up until the alien shit starts turning them into spare parts.
And you? She said.
She meant, was he coming up the well too?
It was the same thing to do.
Not yet, he said. If it escalates any more, maybe. It the aliens or it the people?
Right.
Alex has seen a few more power spikes, and there's more movement, but it's pretty far south of you. If it starts looking more interesting, I'll let you know.
Thank you.
Oh, and you'll be picking up a passenger.
Okay?
It's complicated, but we're putting him on the Rosie because he isn't safe down here anymore. I owe this guy, Naomi. He tried to save my life. Take good care of him.
Okay.
And honey, Holden said, unable to keep the worry out of his voice, when you get back up, keep a close eye on the Israel. I think things might be about to go all the way bad down here, and when they do, they may go bad up there too.
Ha, Naomi said, and he could hear the smile in her voice. Let him try.
Chapter 19. Havelock. The corridor stretched 40 meters between the recycling tanks and the secondary machine shop, with hatches inset every 10 meters. Open lifts at either end led to environmental control fore and hydroponics aft. The age of the Israel showed not only in the design of the walls and the grating of the floor, but also in the green-gray finish of the ceramic. Harsh edges at the doorways marked where safety design had improved in the decades since the ship first flew out past the orbit of Mars. A white scar splashed across one wall where something drastic had happened in some previous era of the ship's history and been patched like painting over graffiti. Havelock fought the urge to press himself into the corner nearest the doorway. It was hard. His species had evolved in the gravity well of Earth, had grown and developed in it. His hind brain told him that pressure meant safety. The angry whispers of the men in the hall set his heart tripping over faster, and the wall, centimeters from his back, seemed to pull at him like a magnet. It was an error waiting to happen. Lean in, push against the wall, and it would push back, sending him out into the open air of the corridor and the firing lines. The second law of thermodynamics as applied to gunfights.
Clear,
one of the engineers said, and Havelock was torn between pleasure and annoyance. Not clear, he thought. They hadn't seen him, so they thought he wasn't there. He held the gun at his leg, stayed still, waited, didn't hug the wall. The first man who floated by didn't notice him until he'd already been shot. Havelock's paint round bloomed orange against the man's chest. The one behind him had already launched, his body sailing between one handhold and the next, unable to change his trajectory. Havelock hit him twice, once in the leg, then in the belly. In a real fight, there would be blood in the air now, fine red droplets spinning into orbs and already coalescing and beginning to clot. The third man was still far enough down the corridor that Havelock didn't have a clear line of sight. Half a dozen blue paint rounds hissed past him, splattering the ceramic bulkhead. Suppressing fire. Not a bad plan, but there was no one left to exploit it. Havelock pulled gently at the handhold behind him to keep from drifting out, reloaded his pistol, and counted incoming rounds. The dead engineer floated in the corridor, a sour expression on his face. Havelock counted 15 rounds, then there was a pause, and the slick metallic sound of the pistol ejecting the paint round magazine. Havelock pulled a few centimeters forward, looking down the hall. The last man, Williams, hadn't even taken cover while he fumbled to reload his gun. Havelock fired 3 times, hitting him only once. The accuracy on the pistol stank, but it was enough to make his point. The last engineer barked out an obscenity.
All right, Havelock said into his hand terminal. That's a wrap, guys. Let's get the cleanup crew out and meet back in the conference room in 30.
It was hard to judge the training sessions. On the one hand, they had been going for 8 days now, and they were not ready for real action. The engineers weren't soldiers. The three who'd had some training earlier in life were so out of practice that they were worse than the absolute beginners.
At least the novices knew they didn't know anything. And on the other hand, they were getting better faster than Havelock had expected. With another week or 10 days, they'd be at least as competent as a squad of rookies. Maybe more. Security trainees were driven by any number of things. The need for a job, an idealistic view of helping people, sometimes just a narcissistic love of violence. The engineers weren't like that. They were more focused, more driven, and there was a palpable sense of the team against the enemy. Murtry's defeat of the terrorist cell downstairs left them at once excited and edgy, and Havelock didn't see anything wrong with the bloodthirst, so long as it was channeled and controlled. For the next half hour, the engineers and the security team, Havelock and the two others from his skeleton crew, went through the corridors, holds, and locks, cleaning up the mess from the exercise. The paint polymerized quickly, peeling off the walls and grates without flaking much or leaving fragments on the float that someone could breathe in. The engineers had also manufactured sets of personal vacuuming systems that filtered everything from tiny particles of the paint casing to volatile molecules out of the air. They laughed and joked and traded friendly insults as they worked, like junior belts cleaning a dojang. Havelock hadn't intended the cleanup as a team-building exercise, but it had worked well enough that he was starting to tell himself that he had. The conference room, where they had the orientation before the exercise and the post-mortem afterward, had been designed for the false gravity of thrust. An oblong table was bolted to the floor with crash couches around it that the engineers didn't use. Havelock didn't know how the decision had been made to ignore the table and rotate the consensus for up and down 90 degrees, but every meeting was like that now. The engineers and security floated against the walls or in the open air, the floor to their right, and Havelock took his place by the main doors. "All right," he said, and the murmur of conversation stopped. "What did we learn?" "Not to trust motherfucking Gibbs when he tells us the corridor's clear." Laughter bubbled after, but it wasn't angry or mean. Even the man being mocked was smiling. "Wrong answer," Havelock said with a grin. "The right answer is don't hurry when you're clearing a space. We have a natural tendency to see an empty space and think it's safe. Doors and corners are always dangerous, because you're moving into something without being sure what's there. By the time you see the enemy, you're exposed to them." "Sir?" Havelock pointed to the woman with a raised hand. "Yes." "Sir, is there an algorithm for this? Because if we could get some kind of best practice flowchart that we could study when we're not here, I think it would help us a lot." "We could classify them by types of doors or corners," someone else said, "and what plane we could use to approach them. Seemed to me like we'd be better off shifting the axis so that whatever we're coming to reads as down." Havelock let them talk for a while. It was funny hearing the tactics of small unit assault analyzed in terms of engineering. But those were his crew now. They were learning to solve violence like an equation. Not to eliminate it, but to understand it fully. "What I don't understand," Chief Engineer Kernan said, "is why we're looking at the Barbapiccola at all." The eyes of the assembled team turned toward Havelock, looking for an answer, or at least a response. A surprising nervousness crawled up his throat, and he chuckled. "They're the bad guys," he said. "The Barbapiccola is an unarmed freighter with a standing crew of maybe 100 people that requires a shuttle to transfer from the surface," the chief engineer said. "The Rocinante runs with less than a skeleton crew, half of which are already off the ship. It seems to me that we have a lower risk, higher value option here." A murmur of agreement passed through the room. Havelock shook his head. "No. First thing is just what you said. The Barbapiccola's unarmed. If things don't go well, the worst we can expect in retaliation is a strongly worded letter. The Rocinante was a state-of-the-art Martian warship before Holden took her to the OPA. God knows what modifications they've made since then. She's got a full rack of torpedoes, PDCs, and a keel-mounted railgun. If the crew on the Rocinante see us as a threat, they can end us, and there's really nothing we can do about it. But if we're the ones with that firepower, Kunin began, we'd be fine as long as we stayed here, Havelock said. But as soon as we go back through the ring gate, there's a whole mess of lawyers, treaties, and other ships with even bigger guns. If we have to commandeer the Barba Piccola, at least we have a legal argument to make. The engineers groaned and shook their heads. Legal arguments were another phrase for bullshit to them, but Havelock pressed on. For one thing, the ore they're carrying is RCE property as long as the UN charter stands. For another, if they bring any of the colonists up from the surface, we can argue they're aiding and abetting murder. Argue? One of the men in the back of the group said. The laughter that followed was bleak. Being true makes it a strong argument, Havelock said. Go after the Rocinante, and we look like everything they say we are. If we stand tough, we can protect ourselves and still win the long game. Long game's great if you're around long enough to play it, the man at the back said. But his tone of voice told Havelock that they'd seen the sense in what he said. For the time being, anyway. Ivers Thorson was a geosensor analyst with advanced degrees from universities on Luna and Ganymede. He made more in a month than Havelock would in a year of working security. Also, he was a belter. Growing up in microgravity hadn't affected him as much as Havelock had seen in other people. Thorson's head was maybe a little big for his body, his spine and legs maybe a little long and thin. With enough exercise and steroids, the man could almost have passed for an earther. Not that it mattered. Everyone on the Israel knew what everyone else was. Back when they'd left home, the differences hadn't mattered. Not much. In addition to the energy spikes, there are 20 heat upwellings that we've seen so far, he said, pointing to the rendered sphere of New Terra on Havelock's desk display. They've all appeared in the last 80 hours. And so far, we don't have any idea what they are. Havelock scratched his head. The cells in the brig were empty, so there was no one to overhear them. No need to be polite. Were you expecting me to have a hypothesis? Because I was under the impression that we were here in order to find a bunch of stuff we didn't know what it was. That you've seen something you don't understand seems pretty much par for the course. The belter's lips pressed thin and pale. This could be important. It could be nothing. My point is that I have to find out. I'm busy with important work. I can't spend all my time dealing with distractions. All right, Havelock said. This is the third day running that someone has sprayed urine in my locker. 3 times, you understand? I'm trying to get my gear not to smell like piss instead of running the numbers. Havelock sighed and canceled out his display. New Terra and its mysterious hotspots vanished. Look, I understand why you don't like it. I'd be cheesed off too. But you have to cut them a little slack. People are bored and they're under pressure. It's natural to get a little rowdy. It'll pass. Thorson folded his arms across his chest, his scowl deepening. A little rowdy? That's what you see? I am the only belter on my team, and I am the only one getting... No, look, just no, all right? Things are tense already. If you want me to, I'll put a monitor on the locker and let people know they need to cool it. But let's not make this into a belters against the inner planets thing. I'm not making it into anything. With all respect, I think you are, Havelock said. And the more you try to make this into a big deal, the more it's going to come back and bite you on the ass. Thorson's rage was palpable. Havelock shifted slightly, pushing himself higher in the direction that they'd temporarily chosen as up. It was an old trick he'd learned back when he'd worked with Star Helix. Humanity might have gone up out of the gravity wells, but the sense of being taller, of establishing dominance, was buried too deeply in the human animal for a little thing like Null G to erase it. Thorson took a deep, shuddering breath. And for a moment, Havelock wondered if he was going to take a swing at him. He didn't want to lock the analyst in a cell for the night, but if it came to it, he wouldn't mind. I'll put a monitor on your locker, and I'll send out a general announcement that people need to put a sock in it. No one will piss on your stuff again, and you can get back to work. That's what you want, right? When you write your announcement, is it going to say that they should stop pulling pranks or that they should stop harassing belters? I think you know the answer to that. Thorson's shoulders hunched, defeated. Havelock nodded. It struck him, not for the first time, that confrontations were like a dance. Certain moves required certain responses, and most of it happened in the lower parts of the brain that language might not even be aware of. Thorson's hunch was an offer of submission, and his nod accepted it. And Thorson probably didn't even know it had happened. Certainly didn't, in fact, because his rational mind kept on dieseling even though everything that needed talking about was already decided. If you were the only Earther and it was Belters doing this, you'd feel different about it. Thank you for letting me know about the problem, Havelock said. I'll see it's addressed. Thorson pushed off from the desk and sailed gracefully through the air, vanishing into the corridor. Havelock sighed, opened his desk display again, and paged through the ship reports. The truth was that incidents were on the rise. Most of it was little things. Complaints of petty infractions of corporate policies. Accusations of hoarding or sexual misconduct. One of the organic chemists had been making euphorics. The ship psychiatric counselor was issuing increasingly strident warnings about something he called internal stratification, which just sounded like social politics as usual to Havelock. He signed off on all the reports. If you were the only Earther. The funny thing was that Havelock had been the only Earther in a Belter society and more than once. When he'd been on a 20-berth hauler from Luna to Ganymede for Stone and Sibbets, he'd been one of two Earthers, outnumbered and always subtly excluded. He'd worked for Star Helix on Ceres Station for the better part of a year, always getting the worst cases, the worst partner, the less than subtle reminders that he didn't belong. He'd been dealt more than his fair share of shit by Belters for not having the right-shaped body or knowing the polyglot mess that passed for a kind of outer planet's cant. They hadn't pissed in his locker, mostly because it hadn't occurred to them. Havelock set a monitor specifically on Thorson's locker, then pulled up a fresh security template. He looked at the empty field, asking him by its blankness what he wanted to say. We're 8 billion clicks from home, and a bunch of half-feral terrorists want to keep on killing us, so let's stay calm. Or maybe, damn near every Belter I've dealt with treated me like I was dipped in shit because of where I came from. But now that we're in the majority, let's all respect their tender little feelings. He cracked his knuckles and started typing. It has come to the attention of security that an increasing number of pranks have been played among the crew. While we all understand the need to keep things light in these stressful times, some of these have gone beyond the realm of good taste. As acting head of security, he paused. Once, on Ceres, Havelock had been assigned to close down an illegal club up near the center of the station where the Coriolis had been vicious and the spin gravity at its least. When he'd gotten to the place, the combination of bright lights, shrieking dub, and his unaccustomed inner ear had left him vomiting in the carved corridors. An image of him had made its way onto the board back in the offices. He played along because objecting would have made it worse. He hadn't thought about that case in years. If you were the only Earther. Fuck, Havelock said to the empty air. He cleared the screen. It has come to my attention that some RCE employees and team members have been singled out for harassment because they are from the outer planets. It is critical, under these stressful conditions, that we not confuse our teammates with our enemies because of accidents of physiology and environments of origin. As such, I am taking the following actions. I'm going to regret this,
Pavlok said to the screen. But by the time he'd finished the announcement, checked it for grammar, and sent it out, he felt almost good.
Chapter 20. Elvie. Sitting outside her hut, her hand terminal resting on her knees, the now familiar sunlight warming her neck and back, Elvie waited for the reports from Luna to buffer. The comm laser on the Edward Israel was the only conduit back to the world she'd known, and it was swamped with technical data flowing out from the work groups on the planetary surface and the sensor data from the Israel. It was sobering to realize that for all the tragedies and fear and death that racked New Terra, most of the raw data going back home was still technical. And her slow connection was more than the townspeople of First Landing had. The Barbapicola didn't even support a feed for them. Their hand terminals were strictly ad hoc, local, line-of-sight networks if they functioned at all. A breeze lifted a whirl of sand, then set it gently down again. High above, the green clouds scattered apart and rejoined, lacing the blue sky like algae floating on the surface of a pond. The air smelled of heat and dust and the distant presentiment of rain. The reports finished loading, and Elvie pulled them up and spent a long hour reading them, listening to the debates, putting together her perspective. It was harder than she liked. Her mind kept jumping around without her. Everything was changing on the planet so quickly, everything was so different than she'd expected it to be, that just maintaining focus was hard. The voyage into the desert, seeing a 2-billion-year-old mechanism actually still functioning, if only barely, had been revelatory. Then the exposure and destruction of the terrorists among the squatters, which should have been a relief, had left her oddly unsettled. And, though she hadn't mentioned it to anyone and never would, she'd been suffering recurring and intrusive dreams about James Holden. On the screen, the research coordinator's report ended, and Elvie realized she hadn't heard any of it. She sighed, restarted it, and stopped it again before the woman back at the RCE labs on Earth could say anything. Elvie looked up at the sky, wondering where the Rosinante and the Barbapicola and the Edward Israel were, hidden by the atmosphere's scatter of blue. One of the plant analogues beside the path leading back to the town let out a volley of rising clicks. It was something she'd wanted to investigate, but she hadn't had the time. Not yet. Dr. Okoye, the research coordinator said from 60 AU away, or half a galaxy, depending on how you looked at it. I've just come from a meeting with the stats team, and I wanted to bring you up to speed on the plan for how we'd like to proceed with the data collection in the next weeks. The Luna Group especially was hoping to request additional samples on several of your initial subjects so that we can narrow our error bars. Elvie listened, focused, pushed away all her other thoughts and feelings. This time, she ended the report with a list of action items. A clear sense of how her work was changing the resources and plans of the labs back home, and a half-dozen questions about mineral sequestration that she wanted to ask Faez. Protocol said she should record a reply and send it out right away. The hours it would take to reach home meant it would arrive before the morning meetings. But instead, she switched to her organizer and began listing her obligations. Water samples and soil samples, samples of three different plant analog species, a report on the alien artifact. She'd been thinking about possible triggers to the artifact's sudden activity, and since Holden had been there, and was, after all, the mediator who was ultimately responsible for making the situation on New Terra better, sensible, sane, she thought maybe, if she could give a solid reason that the artifact in the desert wasn't moving in reaction to their presence, it would take something off his plate. Just as a kindness, and to help support him in making peace. Certainly it wasn't just that she was generating excuses to see him again. She went down the list of things to do, then paused. At the end she wrote,
Letter of recommendation for Felicia Merton. She sat for a long moment, looking at the words, trying to decide how she felt about them. She erased the line, waited, and then entered it in again. Walking into the town was like entering another world, and a harder one. The dirt streets weren't empty, but the people who walked them stayed closer to the walls than they had before. The smiles and nods, the eye contact and simple greetings were all gone. The townspeople walked quickly, with their heads down. Elvie had the urge to stand in their way, block them with her body until they acknowledged that she was there. The building where it had happened stood near the edge of town. The fire had melted what it hadn't burned. The bones of the structure still stood, charred and tilted in the afternoon sun. She paused before them. They reminded her of something, but she couldn't quite remember what. Something dead. Something about fire. Oh, of course. The artifact, burning in the desert. Two of the RCE security force walked down the street in front of her, striding in the middle of the road. She couldn't make out their words, but the tone of the conversation was bright, loose, and celebratory. One of them laughed. Elvie turned, walking toward them. As they passed, one of them lifted a hand in greeting, and Elvie returned it automatically. Across the street, one of the Belter women, Aaron her name was, stepped out from a door, saw the security forces, and hesitated before she came out into the light. Elvie watched the woman walk. Her head a little too high, her shoulders pulled a little too far back. Nothing proved fear, like the effort of rejecting it. First Landing had belonged to that woman once. Elvie stepped into the commissary, hoping to find Holden at his traditional table. The room was dim, and it took her eyes a moment to adjust. The other one, Amos Burton, was there instead, eating a bowl of brown noodles that smelled of fake peanuts and curry. In the back, Lucia Merton sat in a booth with someone. Elvie looked away before the doctor met her gaze. Amos looked up at her as she came close.
I was wondering if Captain Holden... I wanted to talk with him. About the artifacts? In the desert?
Something happened with it?
I had some theories about it that I thought might be useful.
Oh, good God, she thought. I'm stuttering like a schoolgirl. Thankfully, Amos didn't notice, or if he did, he pretended not to.
Captain's off getting ready to transfer the prisoner, Amos said. She'll be back around sundown.
All right, Elvie said. That's fine. If you tell him I was looking for him, I'll likely be in my hut by the time he's back. He can find me there.
I'll let him know.
Thank you.
She turned away, fists pushed into her pockets. She felt humiliated, without being entirely certain why she should. She was just going to offer some perspective on the artifacts and the local ecosystem. There was nothing about it that was at all inappropriate or...
Elvie!
She felt her belly drop. She turned toward the back, toward the booth where Lucia Merton sat. Fires had swiveled around in the chair and was waving at her. She looked at the door to the street, wishing there was some graceful way to get through it.
Elvie, come sit, have a drink with us. Of course, she said, and walked toward the back of the commissary, regretting every step as she took it.
Dr. Merton looked pale except for the bags under her eyes. Elvie wondered if the woman was ill, or if it was just distress and grief.
Lucia, Elvie said.
Elvie?
Sit, Fayez said.
You're standing there, I feel short. I hate feeling short. Elvie smoothed the fabric of her pants and slid in next to Fayez. His smile was beery and amused. Lucia's glance at her was almost an apology.
You could have sat next to me, she seemed to say.
We were just talking about Felicia, Fayez said. Then turned to Lucia.
Elvie is the smartest person on the team. Seriously, do you know that she's the one who wrote the first real paper on cytoplasmic computation? That's her, right there.
Felsius told me about you, Lucius said. Thank you for being a friend to my daughter.